Hi, everybody. My name is Cameron Munter, and I'm the CEO and president of the East West Institute here in New York. Welcome to another episode of the EWI podcast, a platform where we try to dissect some of today's key global issues with leading thinkers and analysts. Today, I have the great pleasure of welcoming a good friend and noted Russia and foreign policy expert, Steve Sestanovich. Steve, welcome to EWI podcast.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
Steve is the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Professor of International Diplomacy at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He has enjoyed a long and diverse professional career serving both in and out of government. His research interests include Russian and post-Soviet politics and foreign policy, which brings us to today's discussion, today's Russia and U.S.-Russian relations. So, Steve, maybe we can dig in by talking about those U.S.-Russian relations such as they are. People have varying opinions, and much is written about the issue in the media. But how do you characterize them? How do you characterize things? Are they as icy as many observers proclaim? Is this a war of words, or are there more serious things, more challenges for influence that we should pay attention to?
Well, icy is not a bad word. I would say yes to that, although it's complicated. And certainly, if there's a problem in Russian-American relations, it's not only because of the issue that tends to command the most attention today, and that is the issue of electoral interference in 2016 and of other kinds of Russian interventions in American domestic affairs. You know, before 2016, we already had the crisis in Ukraine in 2014, when the Russian irregular forces, military, little green men, seized territory in Ukraine and began occupying parts of eastern Ukraine. You had the Russian intervention in Syria in 2015, which was something really unprecedented in modern Russian or Soviet foreign policy, for that matter, a major military intervention in a civil war in the Middle East. You had disputes about arms control violations. The Obama administration had charged that the Russians were violating one of the most important arms control agreements negotiated between the Soviet Union and the United States in the late 80s, the Agreement on Intermediate Nuclear Forces in Europe. And I'm not even including the question of, you know, chemical weapons use in the cathedral town of Salisbury in England, which has been all over the papers of late. So you have a whole string of issues that have given some substance to this war of words, as you referred to it.
Well, Steve, I mean, there's the foreign policy things you've talked about, but there's also the question of the impact of domestic policy as well. I mean, think in the United States of the fights that are going on in Washington between people, we could call them the traditional skeptics of Russian power, and those who, like President Trump apparently, think there are different ways of dealing with things. What about within Russia? You know, one thinks back to these changes, the extraordinary economic and social changes that have taken place in Russia in the last 20 years. Is that a big factor as well? That is to say, are we talking about a different Russian foreign policy, or are we talking about a different kind of interplay between Russian domestic and foreign policy, just like we may be having in the United States?
Well, let me turn to that in one second, Cameron, because it's a really important question. But you did say there was a disagreement among Americans about how to deal with Russia, and I want to flag that for listeners, because in the National Security Strategy, the National Defense Strategy, a whole series of documents issued earlier this year by the Trump administration, Russia is identified as in a new phase of relations with the United States and was grouped with China as the two great power competitors that the United States would have to deal with in the future. There have been different ways of describing relations with both of those two countries. But for the first time in official American documents, we've said what we think they are, and that is great power competitors and great power authoritarian competitors. Now, the issue of how that works in Russian domestic politics, there are some of the familiar features of any foreign policy debate inside any country. There's the question of how the businessmen and the military people and the intelligence people have different perspectives. Do the energy marketers look at relations with the West in the same way that that the KGB does? So you've got bureaucratic politics. You've also got, and Western analysts have increasingly focused on this issue, an extra dimension of foreign policy success as key to legitimacy. People have said that Putin has come to see his domestic support as based on a record of foreign policy achievement. I think it's possible to overstate that, but it's certainly true that after taking Crimea from Ukraine, for example, his popularity numbers went up 20-odd points just virtually overnight. And he has made the theme of Russia's distinctiveness, civilizational distinctiveness, but also kind of edgy competitive relations with the West, a very important part of electoral campaigns, of his presentations to the parliament. This has become part of who he is. But, you know, you have to say that this may be wearing off. Russian polls certainly show that the ordinary Russian is more interested in having the government focus on domestic affairs. Putin's popularity numbers are way down this year as a result primarily of a very ill-managed pension reform. I mean, his popularity approval rating has gone down, a dozen points just in the course of the summer. And one number that I watch is the number of people who would say they'd vote for Putin today. That is now below 50%. It was above 60% just at the beginning of the year. So Putin has been counting on foreign policy to support his view of Russia and his own popularity. Maybe it's not working.
Well, you mentioned at the beginning here the U.S. look at foreign policy, putting China and Russia together as great powers and competitors, as you said, authoritarian great powers. Do you think that that's coherent? I mean, in a sense, one could argue, by the way, the Chinese are very much in favor of what you could call the world order because they benefit from it. They're not there to tear it down, whereas some would say that the Russians look at some of the institutions in the American-dominated world order and want to change them. Therefore, that notion that the American security policy lumps China and Russia together, does that show a little bit of confusion about Russia on our part?
Yeah, I was a little surprised to see the sort of simplicity with which that thought was presented in the American strategic document. I think there are plenty of differences. You know, the Russian economy has done better in the past 20 years, but nothing like the Chinese, and the place that they have, that Russia has in the global economy is, you know, is not to be compared to China. So that the kind of standing that Russia has is almost entirely based on military power, on the legacy of the Cold War nuclear arsenal. That's not nothing. If you've got big territory and vast military forces, you can make your presence felt in the world. And Russian arms sales have been growing importantly. Russian technology is military technology is pretty good, so that they are able to assert themselves in a way that the Chinese might not, for example. So you could make the case that there's a more pressing difficulty posed by Russia in some areas. But I think the reason that there was that kind of focus on Russia and China in the documents, especially issued by the Pentagon, is because the Pentagon wanted to say, look, we've spent almost 20 years now in a focus on terrorism as a big threat in American national security, and we really ought to be looking at the rising great powers that can make trouble for us. And in that respect, China and Russia do seem like a way of refocusing American policy. And I think a lot of people in the national security establishment, and particularly in the armed forces, have been saying, let's try to understand more clearly what the threats are to our security and, you know, make some choices about what our priorities are. I think that explains how you got that funny pairing of the two.
Interesting that our president, who is also, I think, not a big fan of the kind of traditional multilateral agreements and things, looks at great powers and the competition among great powers as, you know, just kind of a natural state of things. How do you think the Trump-Putin summit turned out? How significant was that?
Well, you'll pardon me if I laugh at this question a little bit.
Sure.
I mean, that summit was a disaster.
You're so, such a diplomat.
We don't know the details of the conversations, but what we do know is how the president spun the event afterwards. What he needed to do to try to put the question of Russian electoral interference behind him in some way was to say simply and clearly, I've said to President Putin that electoral interference in our elections is absolutely unacceptable. Nobody will tries to do that will benefit from it, and we will stop it. He got, as is now well established in the public record, very, very confused on this topic, found himself aligned against his own advisors and intelligence community, and everything just spun out of control from there. You know, it was an interesting moment because what seemed to be happening in the administration before the summit and in the aftermath was a kind of assertion of control by the president's advisors. John Bolton had gone to Moscow. It seemed as though he was making this his portfolio, trying to get primary responsibility over it and to gain some greater coherence, begin to address some of the individual problem areas of Russian-American relations. But all of that was kind of lost when the president blew it in the press conference. And Bolton is seemingly going to have to start over. He's got some obvious issues to address, whether it's Ukraine or Syria or nuclear arms control. But the real challenge for him is to kind of keep it out of the president's hands. That's why it was kind of necessary to postpone this summit. But the real issue is, does anything happen outside of a summit? Can you get the advisors to the two presidents dealing with specific problem issues and make some progress on them? I think that it seems as though Trump doesn't really see that as the path to an improvement in relations. And on the Russian side, they're very confused as to who's going to be able to make the decisions and get some momentum going in addressing problem issues. So short answer to your question about what did the Trump-Putin summit contribute moved us back a few steps.
Well, Steve, if the summit did that, what about those issues that are very real out there? Where can the two countries find common ground? What about things like counterterrorism, where there may be common threats? What about the rebuilding of Mosul or Aleppo, energy policy, environment? Or are there areas like in the Arctic where we can work together? What about those perhaps less overarching, but very real issues that many would think there might be common ground? How does one deal with that?
Well, not easy. I think they're, you know, both Russian experts and non-experts have their list of candidates for areas where you can kind of get something going. You know, and I think the most common one, for example, is nuclear arms control. People often say, well, you know, why don't we just extend the New START treaty that was ratified in the Obama administration? The terms of the treaty allow it to be extended for 5 years. Otherwise, it'll expire in 2021. And, you know, there's a lot of support for that. And it's easy to do procedurally. The presidents can just announce it. There are some complications. There are a lot of people in the Congress who will, and the military who will say, gee, what about the INF treaty, which we think the Russians are violating? Or others will say, are we doing this even though the Russians aren't in any way showing any flexibility in Ukraine? You mentioned the issue of counterterrorism or kind of rebuilding in Syria. The Russians have found themselves in a dispute with Europeans whom they've been trying to draw into efforts to promote development in Syria in the wake of the civil war. We're almost at the end of it. And they, you know, they've found the Europeans have pretty much the view that that a lot of Americans do, which is if we're just talking about rebuilding so as to strengthen the Assad regime, you know, that's your problem. President Putin, you know, you made this mess. You go ahead and fix it. That seemed to be the answer that the Germans gave Putin recently. Energy Secretary Perry was in Moscow last week, and the idea was to, you know, explore areas for cooperation. However, what was supposed to be a kind of feel-good meeting ended up being overshadowed by possible new sanctions that the administration is going to impose related to energy, in fact. So when you draw up this list where it sounds as though there are common ground potentials, immediately you're struck by the obstacle. And I haven't even mentioned one of the ones that was on your list, and that's cybersecurity. Anytime this administration talks about cooperation on cybersecurity, its domestic audience just responds with laughter and derision because the administration hasn't given itself any credibility on that issue. It hasn't seemed as though it took cybersecurity vis-a-vis Russia seriously. So I think there are, of course, areas of potential common ground, but not so easy to get there.
But Steve, have we lost the capacity that we had in the Cold War to compartmentalize? That is to say, yes, we have, you know, various things we don't agree on, various things that are kind of not negotiable, but we can try to work together around the margins. And let's use, if I can give a plug for the East-West Institute and what we do, we have a fairly active set of measures of trying to address cybersecurity issues. You know, no bank, whether it's Sberbank or Bank of America, wants to see its deposits stolen. There are some common grounds commercially, whatever one thinks of Russian finance and this kind of thing. There are common interests that we are working on with Russian colleagues on the situation in Afghanistan, whether it's counterterrorism or counter-narcotics, things like that. That is, you're right that I think the overarching element is, you say, cries of derision. Yeah, what about these guys? Why aren't they taking us seriously on Crimea? And yet, is it basically, are we not compartmentalizing? Are we just freezing everything because of the bad behavior that we see on major issues?
You know, I don't think this is just a question of whether or not we compartmentalize, Cameron. But you're absolutely right to mention that idea that people had in the different phases of the Cold War. You know, let's put aside our competition in this area and focus on maybe limiting it in another area. There was always, of course, the counter strategy known as linkage, which is a term that I believe Henry Kissinger originated. But I would say compartmentalization depends on this. It depends on signaling that you're going to have a credible policies in the areas that you don't try to resolve, so that people are going to be more inclined to say to the administration, for example, it's good to go ahead and extend the New START treaty if they think that the administration is kind of credible overall on issues involving the Russians. So tough on Ukraine, for example. Here, I think the administration has actually not managed to get enough credit for itself because it has, for example, been pretty tough on Ukraine. Have they provided lethal equipment, for example, to the Ukrainians, where the Obama administration didn't want to do that? And there are, you know, there are other cases where being actually pretty vigorous and proactive on sanctions questions should have given the administration a little more flexibility to push forward in areas where there might be some cooperative possibility. I think the problem is that overall, the approach to Russia looks too incoherent, too confused, possibly involving too many sort of secret calculations that make people, you know, American critics, and especially in the Congress, but also elsewhere in the administration, make people uneasy about where the administration is headed. You need to establish a kind of basic credibility and confidence level, and then you can compartmentalize.
Well, then, in your opinion, is there a way then that we should reframe American or Western perception on the road forward with Russia? Is there a way to do this? I mean, yes, we'd like to see leadership from the White House. Yes, we'd like to see leadership from the Congress, or perhaps even from the business community or the American defense community and diplomatic community. But how do we reframe the Western perception of how the road forward can go? You know, where do you see the countries 5 to 10 years down the road? I recall a conversation that I had with John Huntsman in Moscow, where he said, you know, we really have to look to the long game here. This isn't going to get better in the short run. We have to look to the long game. If we're looking that way, what roads do we take? What openings do we have in the long game?
Well, I certainly agree that we need to have a fuller view of this relationship. And that means more issues, longer time horizons, and more players brought into the process. Right now, election interference and collusion are issues that we are, for very, very understandable reasons, very preoccupied by. But they may not be the most important issues that we have to worry about, both for affecting creating a Russian-American relationship that we're happy with, or for seeing where things are headed in Russia. Let me just give you two examples where a little reframing could be useful. I think there are, you know, leaving aside the ways in which the Russians may have interfered in our elections, that in the many ways that they clearly did, there are much broader sort of tectonic shifts underway in geopolitics that we need to take account of. You just had a summit between Putin and Xi Jinping. You've got major military exercises in the Far East going on that the two countries are joining in. And that kind of alignment is one that we need to think about hard. We need also to understand what the future of American policy in the Middle East is going to be now that the Russians have established themselves as a far more formidable player in the region. What does that suggest about the way in which we need to handle our relationships with other countries in the region? There may be some openings for cooperation, but I think they're probably going to depend quite a lot on whether the United States can do some of the necessary things to reestablish its own position in the region, which has taken a lot of hits over the past 5 years. So figuring out how to achieve and protect American interests at a time when the Russians are a more significant international player, I think is, you know, another part of this relationship that we need to be focused on. But I think we also need to, and this is where we were in the conversation, kind of back toward the beginning. we need also to be paying more attention to Russian internal politics, because there are uncertainties there over the next decade that are have the potential to refashion the relationship yet again, both in good and bad directions. You know, Putin is not forever. People always talk about him as somebody who's going to, die in office, die with his boots on, have to be dragged out of the Kremlin. But, you know, recent developments, I think, make it much more likely that in the early part of the next decade, there'll be a political transition in Russia. And we want to position ourselves in a way to have a relationship with the political forces that dominate in that period, a good relationship if we can, a testy and difficult and competitive one if we have to. And we shouldn't be thinking that Russia is only Putin. So we've got to look beyond the narrow focus that we have for very understandable reasons today, and prepare ourselves for a relationship that 5 or 10 years down the road is likely to look very different than what we have today.
So, Steve, to sum up, what I hear you say is two very interesting things. One is that we have to look at a policy of bank shots, if you will, that it's not just all about the U.S.-Russia relationship in the 21st century. It's about U.S. and Russia in a changing context, whether it's the Middle East and the players in the Middle East, whether it's the relationship with China, whether it's the changing economic relationships and things of that sort. So that in foreign policy, a mere bilateral relationship is not sufficient. Similarly, that for us to look at it purely as foreign policy is also a mistake, that we have to take into account some very real changes that are taking place domestically. Do I have you right on that?
I couldn't have put it better myself, Cameron. I think that's exactly right. And let me just underscore one of the reasons for the former point you made, and that is Russia isn't such a big factor in the world that we should be focusing on us and them and thinking that we can address very much just bilaterally or in a kind of a one-on-one competition. The Russians are a factor in a lot of different regions and a lot of different issue areas where we want to figure out whether they're becoming more important, less important, but in any case, how they are part of the equation that we have to deal with in order to produce results that are good for the United States. And that's just not going to be an analysis that is like what we could have done 20 years ago or 10 years ago. 10 years from now, it won't be the kind of analysis that we do today. So there are a lot of challenges in figuring out where we want to be with the Russians. And I think the two frames that the lenses that you've suggested, Russia in context and Russian domestic politics, those are both key for understanding where we want to get.
Well, then, I'm glad to see we have a meeting of minds. And before we close the show, I'd like to again thank Steve Sasanovich for joining us and sharing his insights on the current state of U.S.-Russia relations, which doesn't exist in a vacuum, whether it's domestic politics in Russia or the world around us. So it sounds, Steve, like what we've got here is a blueprint for a very tough road ahead. You'd agree?
Absolutely. more podcasts are called for.
So with that, please remember to look to us on our website, SoundCloud and iTunes, under the name of East West Institute, where you can listen, follow, and subscribe so you don't miss our conversations. Thank you all for listening.